Since then, whenever they make a purchase, he has turned to his wife to negotiate, knowing that he would be a doormat. To be honest, I've been ashamed of this for a long time, he admits. After he left the professional services firm, Samir completed an MBA and received a job offer from a Fortune 500 medical technology company, his ideal employer. He wasn't entirely satisfied with the terms of the offer, but, as usual, he was reluctant to negotiate. I felt awkward. I like my boss, and I didn't want to make him uncomfortable. Weakening Samir's position further, the economy had just crashed, and his peers were all signing without negotiating. But something was different this time. By a couple months later, Samir had negotiated increases in his total compensation to the tune of more than $70,000. He had undergone a chump change, transforming from his traditional doormat status into a more assertive, more successful negotiator. My wife was stunned, and she complimented my persistence and effectiveness as a negotiator, he says. For her to see me as a good negotiator is the ultimate validation. What was it that drove Samir to step up to the plate? The answer can be found in an ingenious experiment conducted by Linda Babcock and her colleagues. The participants were 176 senior executives from private and public organizations, with titles ranging from CEO and COO to president, general manager, and chairman. The executives all started with the same information. An employee in a software company was being promoted, and they were negotiating compensation for the new position. The male executives playing the role of the employee landed an average of $146,000, 3% higher than the women's average of $141,000. But with a single sentence, Babcock and colleagues helped the female executives boost their averages to $167,000, outdoing the men by 14%. All it took was to tell them they were playing a different role. Instead of imagining that they were the employee, the female executives were asked to imagine that they were the employee's mentor. Now the women were agents advocating for someone else. Interestingly, they didn't set higher goals, but they were willing to push harder to achieve their goals, which led them to better outcomes. In a similar study, researchers Emily Amanatala and Michael Morris asked men and women to negotiate the terms of an attractive job offer. Half were instructed to imagine that they had received the offer themselves and negotiate accordingly. The other half were instructed to imagine that they had referred a friend for the job and were now responsible for negotiating on behalf of the friend. Once again, all of the participants set similar goals, irrespective of whether they were male or female, or negotiating for themselves or a friend. But their actual behavior in the negotiations varied strikingly. Regardless of whether they were negotiating for themselves or others, the men requested starting salaries averaging $49,000. The women followed a different path. When they were negotiating for themselves, they requested starting salaries averaging only $42,000, 16.7% lower than the men. This discrepancy vanished when the women negotiated on behalf of a friend. As advocates, women did just as well as the men, requesting an average of $49,000. In another study, Amanatala and Morris found the same results with experienced executives negotiating. Male executives landed the same salaries regardless of whether they were negotiating for themselves or others, whereas female executives did much better when negotiating for others than themselves. And Vanderbilt professors Bruce Berry and Ray Friedman found that in short-term, single-issue negotiations, givers do worse than takers, because they're willing to give larger slices of the pie to their counterparts. But this disadvantage disappears entirely when the givers set high goals and stick to them, which is easier for givers to do when advocating for someone else. Advocating for others was the key to Samir's chump change. When he shied away from negotiating with his initial employer, Samir was thinking about his own interests. With the Fortune 500 medical technology company, he put himself in a different frame of mind. He was representing his family's interests. Although he might be a doormat when he was responsible for himself, being a giver meant that he didn't want to let other people down. I used it as a psychological weapon against myself, to motivate myself, Samir says. The solution was thinking about myself as an agent, an advocate for my family. As a giver, I feel guilty about pushing too much. But the minute I start thinking, I'm hurting my family who's depending on me for this, I don't feel guilty about pushing for that side. By thinking of himself as an agent representing his family, Samir summoned the resolve to make an initial request for a higher salary and tuition reimbursement. This was an otherish strategy. On the one hand, he was doing what givers do naturally, advocating for other people's interests. On the other hand, he intentionally advocated for his family, whose interests were closely aligned with his own. At the same time, he wasn't pushing so far as to become a taker. He sought a balance in meeting his family's interests and his company's. My value system means that I'm not going to do anything that's wrong or unfair, Samir explains. I'm not going to try to gouge anyone, but I am going to push to the point that's right and fair. When Samir first contacted his new boss to negotiate, he asked for a salary increase and reimbursement of his MBA tuition. This matched what other firms were offering, but the boss came back with disappointing news from HR. They weren't able to grant either request. At that point, Samir felt the urge to back down. He wanted to be a giver toward his boss, and he was worried that getting more money would harm his boss's performance or compromise his budget. But Samir had massive debt from student loans, and he felt responsible for his family first. He asked again, convincing his boss to lobby HR for the bump in his salary and signing bonus. He ended up getting a $5,000 salary increase and a $5,000 signing bonus increase. By that time, his $10,000 signing bonus had expired. Samir asked for that too, and got it. His boss assured him that this was the best he could do. Samir was already up $20,000 in the first year alone, not to mention the dividends that the base salary increase would accrue. But he wasn't done yet. He still wasn't receiving tuition reimbursement, so he was determined to find another way to support his family. He had plenty of free time during his last semester of school, so he negotiated a consulting arrangement to work for the company part-time. The company agreed to pay him $135 per hour, which would net Samir another $50,000 in the span of a few months. At that point, he signed the contract, having upped his total compensation by more than $70,000. Being able to keep pushing. A large part of that was being an agent, Samir says. If I don't push now, what's going to happen when I get another promotion? I'm going to be that guy who has three kids and gets pushed around. Thinking of myself as an agent motivated me to keep going. It gave me some extra cojones. Although advocating for his family helped him succeed, Samir was still concerned about how it would affect his reputation at the firm and his relationship with his boss. When the negotiation was finished, his boss shared a surprising sentiment. He admired Samir's assertiveness. "It was part of why my boss wanted me," Samir says. "He respected that I wasn't going to be pushed around anymore." Givers, particularly agreeable ones, often overestimate the degree to which assertiveness might be off-putting to others. But Samir didn't just earn respect by virtue of negotiating. His boss was impressed with how he negotiated. When HR initially rejected Samir's request, he explained his family's circumstances. "I don't just have to worry about paying rent now. I have a family to support and loans to repay. Can you make this more palatable for me?" By asking on behalf of his family instead of himself, Samir was maintaining an image as a giver. He showed that he was willing to advocate for others, which sent a positive signal about how hard he would work when representing the company's interests. Babcock and colleagues call this a relational account, an explanation for a request that highlights concern for the interests of others, not only oneself. When women ask for a higher salary, they run the risk of violating expectations that they will be other-oriented and caring, giving rather than taking in character, Babcock writes with Hannah Riley Bowles. Whereas women may be uniquely worried that assertiveness will violate gender norms, givers of both sexes worry about violating their reciprocity preferences. If they push too hard, they'll feel like takers rather than givers. But when givers are advocating for someone else, pushing is closely aligned with their values of protecting and promoting the interests of others. Givers can chalk it up to caring. And by offering relational accounts, givers do more than just think of themselves as agents advocating for others. They present themselves as agents advocating for others, which is a powerful way to maintain their self-images and social images as givers. This reasoning proved relevant to Lillian Bauer when she decided to stop letting clients treat her like a doormat. "I want to be generous and build trust with clients, but that doesn't mean they can walk all over me," Bauer notes. To decline requests from clients that fell outside the scope of a project, she used a combination of advocacy and relational accounts. Starting with advocacy, Bauer began to think about herself as an agent for the consultants on her team. Givers have a protective side. "In negotiating with a client, I feel a lot of responsibility for my team, and it makes me more willing to draw a hard line." Then, she developed a habit of articulating this responsibility to her clients. "When a client makes an unreasonable request, I explain that it's going to stretch my team or kill them working crazy hours. The client knows I will bend over backward to do what's right for them. So when I do push back, it has a lot more impact. There's a good reason for it." Pushing past pushover. Lillian's progress struck a chord with me. As a freshman in college, I accepted a job selling advertisements for the Let's Go travel guides. Written and produced entirely by Harvard students, the Let's Go guides were billed as the Bible of the budget traveler, rivaling Lonely Planet, Frommer's, and Rick Steves as the go-to resource for getting around a foreign country on the cheap. On my first day, my manager handed me a list of clients and said, "These people spent about $300,000 last year on ads in the Let's Go books. Just call them up and convince them to advertise again." Then she turned around and walked away. As I realized that I wouldn't get any training, I began to panic. I had no product knowledge and no relevant experience, and I had never left North America. I was only 18 years old, and I had no business making sales pitches to senior vice presidents at major international companies. I mustered up the courage to call one of Let's Go's longtime advertisers, a man named Steven, who ran a travel agency. The moment he started talking, It was clear he was furious. At first, I was glad to see that my agency was written up in the books, separate from my ad, he snarled, until I saw that outdated contact information was listed. So your readers can reach me, I've had to pay hundreds of dollars to maintain old postal addresses and email accounts. I gently explained that advertising and editorial are separate departments. I could ensure the accuracy of his ads, but I had no influence over the content of the books themselves. Stephen didn't care. He demanded an advertising discount to make up for the editorial error and threatened not to renew his ad if I didn't comply. Feeling bad for him, I granted him a 10% discount. This violated a Let's Go policy that appeared in my contract, prohibiting all discounts that didn't appear in our media kit. And it was a preview of more mistakes to come. After contacting several dozen clients, I had given three more discounts and signed very few contracts, which became mortifying when I learned that Let's Go had a 95% client renewal rate. Along with bringing in no revenue, when a client demanded a refund on the previous year's ad, I caved, becoming the first employee to give away money that was already on the books. In empathizing with clients and trying to meet their needs in any way possible, I was helping them at my own expense, not to mention my company's. I was a disaster, and I was ready to quit. It wasn't the first time I had been a giver to a fault. When I was 14, I decided to become a springboard diver. I was determined to master the art of hurling myself into the air, doing somersaults and twists, and entering the water gracefully, without a splash. Never mind that I could hardly jump, flip, or twist, I was terrified to try new dives, and my teammates called out my lack of flexibility by nicknaming me Frankenstein. One day, my coach brought a metronome to practice in the hopes of improving my timing. After several hours of effort, he declared me incapable of rhythm. For the next 4 years, I trained 6 hours a day. Eventually, I became a 2-time state finalist, a 2-time Junior Olympic national qualifier, and an All-American diver. I would go on to compete at the NCAA varsity level at Harvard. But along the way, I sacrificed my own success. Several months before the biggest meet of my life, I volunteered to coach two of my competitors. I taught them new dives, critiqued their form, and revealed the secret of the rip entry, showing them how to disappear into the water at the end of a dive. They returned the favor by beating me at the state championships by just a handful of points. At Let's Go, I was once again benefiting others at a personal cost. Although I was helping my clients save money, I was a pushover, losing revenues for the company and sacrificing my own commission. But the following week, I happened to meet a new assistant manager at Let's Go, whose position was created as a result of the advertising revenue that my predecessor generated. The job made it possible for her to pay for school. It was the inspiration that I needed. I realized that my colleagues were depending on me. As a student, I didn't have a wife and children yet, but I could see myself as an agent on behalf of college students in search of jobs that would defray the cost of tuition and provide meaningful work experiences. I might be a doormat when lobbying solely for my own interests, but when I was representing the interests of students, I was willing to fight to protect them. Before a heated negotiation with a merciless French hotelier who demanded a discount, I thought about how the revenue could support job creation, which gave me the resolve to dig in my heels. I added a relational account. If I gave him a discount, it would only be fair to offer the same to our other clients, and I had a responsibility to be consistent. He ended up paying the full price. After 4 months, I had set company records by bringing in more than $600,000 in revenue, nearly doubling my predecessor's tally, and landing more than $230,000 from cold calls to new prospects. I sold the largest advertising package in company history, and our president announced at a banquet that I was one of the finest advertising associates ever to come through the company. At age 19, I was promoted to director of advertising sales, which put me in charge of a budget above $1 million and tasked me with hiring, training, and motivating my own staff. Right after I was promoted, the internet bubble collapsed. More than a dozen clients went out of business before our advertising season even started, and 6 of our 10 biggest clients informed me that their advertising budgets had been slashed, so they wouldn't be able to renew. When all was said and done, Let's Go lost 22 loyal clients and 43% of the total budget from the previous year. The worst blow came when our largest client called. It was Michael, the vice president of the student travel agency, that had purchased the record-setting package the previous year. "I'm very sorry to tell you this, because we love your product and value this relationship." Michael took a deep breath. "But due to budget constraints and a declining travel market, I'm not sure if we can afford to advertise this year at all. To even consider it, we'll need a major discount." Knowing that many jobs depended on revenue from Michael's company, I became an advocate and pushed back. Because his rivals were pulling their ads, I told Michael, it was an opportunity to gain a leg up on the competition. And what better time to invest than during a recession? He said he would check with his boss and get back to me. The following week, he called with bad news. He had authorization to advertise in our books only if he could have the same package as the prior year, and only with a 70% discount. This would slash his expenditure of just under $120,000 to below $40,000. While I was trying to figure out how much of a discount we could afford, I went to coach a diving practice. Sitting on the pool deck, it dawned on me that there was a major difference between diving and Let's Go. Individual sports involved zero-sum contests, where helping competitors win meant that I would be more likely to lose. In business, though, win-win was possible. My client's interests didn't have to be at odds with my own. When I began to contemplate Michael's interests, I realized that he might value products to give away for free in his store. I learned from colleagues that our publishing contract gave Let's Go the rights to sell or license any content that didn't exceed 20 pages. So I offered him sponsorship of a new product, 20-page Let's Go travel booklets that he could hand out to customers. Customers would appreciate the free travel tips and might stay longer in the store or be more likely to return. Since the funds would come from his distribution budget rather than his advertising budget, he was able to consider the possibility. When I gave further thought to Michael's interests, I realized that the booklets would be more valuable to him if he could sponsor them exclusively, rather than featuring other companies' ads. We agreed on a mutually beneficial deal for exclusive sponsorship, and he ended up spending more than $140,000, topping my own previous record for the largest ad package in company history. Whereas advocacy and relational accounts enabled me to become more assertive in win-lose negotiations, it was perspective-taking that helped me expand the pie and succeed in win-win negotiations. Ultimately, despite the dot-com bust, this approach led more than half of our renewal clients to increase their ad packages. Our team brought in more than $550,000 in profits, making it possible to increase the size of our staff and introduce new marketing initiatives. After months of hounding delinquent clients to send their payments, I became the only manager in recent history to bring in 100% of accounts receivable, leaving no bad debt. I was elected to the company's board of directors and earned the Manager of the Year award for leadership, commitment, and business acumen. The lessons I learned at Let's Go stuck with me, and I decided to spend the rest of my career teaching other givers what I had discovered about overcoming the doormat effect. For a number of years, researchers have known that successful negotiators tend to operate in an otherish fashion. In a comprehensive analysis of 28 different studies led by Dutch psychologist Karsten de Drew, the best negotiators weren't takers or selfless givers. The takers focused on claiming value. They saw negotiations as zero-sum, win-lose contests, and didn't trust their opponents, so they bargained aggressively, overlooking opportunities to create value through developing an understanding of their counterpart's interests. The selfless givers made too many concessions, benefiting their counterparts at a personal cost. The most effective negotiators were otherish. They reported high concern for their own interests and high concern for their counterparts' interests. By looking for opportunities to benefit others and themselves, otherish givers are able to think in more complex ways and identify win-win solutions that both takers and selfless givers miss. Instead of just giving away value, like selfless givers, otherish givers create value first. By the time they give slices of pie away, the entire pie is big enough that there's plenty left to claim for themselves. They can give more and take more. This notion of expanding the pie captures a turning point in Lillian Bauer's career. Although she had learned to push back with clients and place boundaries on the time she spent mentoring and helping takers, she wasn't willing to let go of helping givers and matchers. When junior associates who didn't seem like takers needed help, she still gave in a selfless manner, sacrificing inordinate amounts of her time regardless of her own schedule and demands. Jason Geller adopted a more otherish approach. He found a way to expand the amount of giving he could accomplish without increasing the demands on his time. Geller engaged others in sharing the workload, creating opportunities for them to become givers, while keeping himself from becoming overloaded. As a senior manager, when junior analysts asked him for help, Geller would suggest a lunch and invite a couple newer managers to come along. This opened the door for the managers to have access to him, and for them to provide mentoring to the junior analysts. It's a great way for them to build the support of folks more junior to them, he says. Instead of doing all of the giving himself, he was able to connect junior analysts with multiple mentors, who provided a broader base of knowledge and advice. After being told she was too generous, Bauer adopted an approach that resembled Geller's. She started doing group mentoring sessions instead of only one-on-ones. I ask myself, am I really the only person who can help in this particular instance? I tried not to think about myself as the only resource I was optimizing and started connecting people to help each other. Now I'm quite explicit with my mentees. I tell them, people did this for me, and you need to do this for other people. There is an expectation that when you receive that kind of generosity from people, you need to pay it forward. By deciding not to carry the burden alone, Bauer expanded the pie, enabling her giving to have a broader impact while protecting her own time. If you have a natural mix of givers, takers, and matchers in your company, Bauer says, you can do a lot to magnify the giver tendency, suppress the more aggressive taker tendencies, and shift the matchers toward giving. There's an energy and a satisfaction that you get out of it. In its own way, it's addictive. Instead of assuming that they're doomed to become doormats, successful givers recognize that their everyday choices shape the results they achieve in competitive, confrontational situations. The dangers lie less in giving itself, and more in the rigidity of sticking with a single reciprocity style across all interactions and relationships. As the psychologist Brian Little puts it, even if a style like giving is our first nature, our ability to prosper depends on developing enough comfort with a matching approach that it becomes second nature. Although many successful givers start from the default of trusting others' intentions, they're also careful to scan their environments to screen for potential takers, always ready to shift from feeling a taker's emotions to analyzing a taker's thoughts, and flex from giving unconditionally to a more measured approach of generous tit for tat. And when they feel inclined to back down, successful givers are prepared to draw reserves of assertiveness from their commitments to the people who matter to them. For Lillian Bauer, these shifts in strategy catalyzed a chump change. As Bauer learned to leverage her natural strengths in advocating for others and reading other people's motives, she adapted her behavior to invest in those on whom she could have the greatest influence and encourage them to give as well. The cumulative effect was that she transformed from a doormat into a successful giver. Even though her generosity initially slowed her rise to partner, she ended up getting there ahead of schedule. Lillian Bauer was one of the first members of her consulting class to make partner. Chapter 8. The Scrooge Shift. Why a soccer team, a fingerprint, and a name can tilt us in the other direction. How selfish soever a man may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortunes of others, and render their happiness necessary to him, although he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it. Adam Smith, Father of Economics. In 1993, a man named Craig Newmark left IBM after 17 years to take a computer security position at Charles Schwab in San Francisco. As a single guy new to the Bay Area, he was looking for ways to spice up his social life. In early 1995, he started emailing friends to share information about local arts and technology events. Word of mouth spread, and people began to expand the postings beyond events to feature job openings, apartments, and miscellaneous items for sale. By June, the email list had grown to 240 people. It was too large for direct email, so Craig moved it to a listserv. In 1996, a website was born, and it was called Craigslist. By the end of 2011, there were Craigslist sites in more than 700 locations around the world. In the United States alone, roughly 50 million people visit Craigslist each month, making Craigslist one of the 10 most popular websites in the country, and one of the 40 most visited in the world. Craigslist flourished by appealing to our basic matcher instincts. It facilitates transactions in which buyers and sellers can agree on a fair price, exchanging goods and services for what they're worth. Fundamentally, Craigslist is about trading value in direct exchanges between people, creating a matcher's preferred, even balance of give and take. "We're not altruistic," Newmark writes. "From one perspective, we're like a flea market." Could a system like this function based entirely on giving instead of matching? In 2003, an Ohio native by the name of Darren Beal decided to find out. Just like Craig Newmark, Beal was in a new city where he lacked information, so he started an email list of friends. Following the lead from Craigslist, Beal was aiming to create internet-based local communities of exchange for anyone to access, connecting people who wanted goods with people who were ready to part with them. But in a radical departure from the typical Craigslist exchange, Beal set an unusual ground rule. no currency or trading allowed. The network was called Free Cycle, and all goods had to be given away for free. The idea for Free Cycle was sparked when Beale developed and ran a recycling program for businesses at a nonprofit organization called Rise in Tucson, Arizona. Local businesses began to give Beale used items that were still in good condition but weren't recyclable, like computers and desks. In the hopes of giving the items away to people who needed them, Beale spent hours on the phone offering them to charities, but made little progress. At the same time, he had a bed that he wanted to give away, but thrift shops wouldn't accept it. He realized that he might be able to solve both of these problems with an online community that matched givers and receivers more efficiently. Beale sent an initial email announcing FreeCycle to about 40 friends, inviting them to join and spread the word. When some of the earliest FreeCycle members started posting items to give away, Beale was caught off guard. One woman offered to give away a partially used bottle of hair dye, which would expire in a matter of hours. "It needs to be used really soon," she wrote, "so if anyone has an urge to go darker, tonight is the night." A Texas man posted a more desirable item, fishing tackle, but had a string attached. He would only give it away to someone from whom fishing tackle had been stolen. "As a kid 34 years ago, I stole a tackle box. There's no way I can find the person and make it right. So I'm trying to do the next best thing." With some people finding matcher loopholes in the system, and others trying to give away junk, FreeCycle seemed like a lost cause. But Beale believed that one person's trash really is another's treasure. And some people gave away actual treasure on FreeCycle that they could have easily sold on Craigslist. One person donated a camera in excellent condition, worth at least $200. Others gave away good computers, flat-screen TVs, baby car seats, pianos, vacuum cleaners, and exercise equipment. When FreeCycle started in May 2003, there were 30 members. Within a year, FreeCycle had grown at an astonishing rate. There were more than 100,000 members in 360 cities worldwide. By March 2005, FreeCycle had increased tenfold in membership, reaching 1 million members. Recently, social scientists Rob Willer, Frank Flynn, and Sonia Zak decided to study what drives people to participate in exchange systems. They were striving to get to the bottom of a vigorous debate among social scientists, many of whom believe that the types of direct exchanges that take place on Craigslist were the optimal way of exchanging resources. By allowing people to trade value back and forth, a system like Craigslist capitalizes on the fact that most people are matchers. But some experts anticipated the rapid growth of systems like FreeCycle, where members give to one person and receive from another, never trading value back and forth with the same person. These researchers were convinced that although such a generalized reciprocity system relies on people to be givers and can be exploited by takers, it could be just as productive in facilitating the exchange of goods and services as direct matching. The intuitive explanation is that the two types of systems attract different types of people. Perhaps matchers were drawn to Craigslist, whereas givers flocked to FreeCycle. As Darren Beale told me, if there were only takers, there would be no FreeCycle. But Willer's team found that this wasn't the whole story. Although FreeCycle grew in part by attracting people who already leaned strongly in the giver direction, it accomplished something much more impressive. Somehow, FreeCycle managed to encourage matchers and takers to act like givers. To figure out how FreeCycle works, Willer's team studied random samples of members at both Craigslist and FreeCycle. They collected surveys from more than 1,000 members of the two exchange organizations from dozens of communities around the United States, measuring reciprocity styles by asking members to answer a series of questions about whether they generally preferred to maximize their own gains or contribute to others. The givers had donated an average of 21 items on FreeCycle. The takers could have given nothing, but they had given away an average of more than 9 items each on FreeCycle. Interestingly, in fact, people often join FreeCycle to take, not give. People usually hear about FreeCycle as a way to get free stuff. Your average person will join thinking, "I can get something for nothing," Beal says. But a paradigm shift kicks in. We had a big wave of new parents who needed help in hard times. They received strollers, car seats, cribs, and high chairs. Later, instead of selling them on Craigslist, they started giving them away. What drives people to join a group with the intention of taking, but then end up giving? The answer to this question opens up another way that givers avoid the bottom of the success ladder. When dealing with individuals, it's sensible for givers to protect themselves by engaging in sincerity screening and acting primarily like matchers in exchanges with takers. But in group settings, there's a different way for givers to make sure that they're not being exploited. Get everyone in the group to act more like givers. The strategy was foreshadowed by Jason Geller and Lillian Bauer, who directly asked their mentees to pay it forward in mentoring groups of more junior colleagues. Earlier, Adam Rifkin, the Silicon Valley giver who was named Fortune's best networker, did the same thing in his entire network. He invited the people who benefited from his giving to help other people in his web of relationships, and a giving norm evolved. As I noted in the opening chapter, people rarely have a single reciprocity style that they apply uniformly to every domain of their lives. If a group develops a norm of giving, members will uphold the norm and give, even if they're more inclined to be takers or matchers elsewhere. This reduces the risks of giving. When everyone contributes, the pie is larger, and givers are no longer stuck contributing far more than they get. What is it about groups that can tilt members in the giver direction? At the end of this chapter, I'll introduce you to a powerful activity that some of the world's leading companies and business schools have started using to motivate giving among takers and matchers, as well as givers. But first, by unpacking FreeCycle's success in motivating matchers and takers to give, we can gain a deeper understanding of what individuals and organizations can do to foster greater levels of giving. The starting point is to ask why people give in the first place. The altruism debate. For nearly 40 years, two of the world's most distinguished psychologists have locked horns over whether the decision to give can be purely altruistic or whether it's always ultimately selfish. Rather than debate philosophy, each has come to battle wielding a deadlier weapon, the psychological experiment. The defendant of pure altruism is C. Daniel Batson, who believes that we engage in truly selfless giving when we feel empathy for another person in need. The greater the need, and the stronger our attachment to the person experiencing it, the more we empathize. When we empathize with a person, we focus our energy and attention on helping him or her, not because it will make us feel good, but because we genuinely care. Batson believes that although some people feel empathy more intensely and frequently than others, virtually all humans have the capacity for empathy, even the most disagreeable of takers. As Adam Smith put it centuries ago, the emotion which we feel for the misery of others is by no means confined to the virtuous and humane, though they perhaps may feel it with the most exquisite sensibility. The greatest ruffian, the most hardened violator of the laws of society, is not altogether without it. The devil's advocate is Robert Cialdini, who argues that there's no such thing as pure altruism. He believes that human beings are frequently generous, giving, and caring. But he doesn't think these behaviors are entirely altruistic in origin. He believes that when others hurt, we hurt, and this motivates us to help. Cialdini's first challenge to Batson's claims was that when empathy leads us to help, it's not because our ultimate goal is to benefit the other person. He proposed that when others are in need, we feel distressed, sad, or guilty. To reduce our own negative feelings, we help. Cialdini accumulated an impressive body of studies suggesting that when people feel distressed, guilty, or sad toward another person in need, they help. Batson's rebuttal? It's true that people sometimes help to reduce negative feelings, but this isn't the only reason. And negative feelings don't always lead to helping. When we feel distressed, sad, or guilty, our ultimate goal is to reduce those negative feelings. In some cases, helping is the strategy we choose. But in many cases, we can reduce our negative feelings in other ways, such as distracting ourselves or escaping the situation altogether. Batson figured out a clever way to tease apart whether empathy drives us to help because we want to reduce another person's distress or our own distress. If the goal is to reduce our own distress, we should choose whatever course of action makes us feel better. If the goal is to reduce another person's distress, we should help even when it's costly and other courses of action would make us feel good. In one experiment, Batson and colleagues gave people a choice. Watch a woman receive electric shocks or leave the experiment to avoid the distress. Not surprisingly, 75% left. But when they felt empathy for the woman, only 14% left. The other 86% stayed and offered to take the shocks in her place. And of the people who stayed to help, the ones who empathized the most strongly were willing to endure 4 times as many shocks as those who felt less empathy. Batson and colleagues demonstrated this pattern in more than half a dozen experiments. Even when people can reduce their negative feelings by escaping the situation, if they're feeling empathy, they stay and help anyway, at a personal cost of time and pain. On the basis of this evidence, Batson concluded that reducing bad feelings is not the only reason people help, and a comprehensive analysis of 85 different studies backed him up. But Cialdini, one of the greatest social thinkers of our time, wasn't done yet. He acknowledged that empathy can drive helping. Feelings of concern and compassion certainly motivate us to act for the benefit of others at a personal cost. But he wasn't convinced that this reflects pure altruism. He argued that when we empathize with a victim in need, we become so emotionally attached that we experience a sense of oneness with the victim. We merge the victim into our sense of self. We see more of ourselves in the victim. And this is why we help. We're really helping ourselves. Quoting Adam Smith again, by the imagination we place ourselves in his situation, we conceive ourselves enduring all the same torments. We enter, as it were, into his body and become, in some measure, the same person with him, and thence form some idea of his sensations, and even feel something. Cialdini and colleagues conducted numerous experiments supporting this idea. Empathy leads to a sense of oneness, or self-other overlap, and this leads to greater helping. Batson's team came back with another rebuttal. That is altruism. If we empathize with other people to the point of merging our own identities with theirs, we care about them as much as we care about ourselves. Because we no longer place our interests above theirs, helping them is purely altruistic. Stalemate. Both camps agree that empathy leads to helping. Both camps agree that a sense of oneness is a key reason why. But they fundamentally differ about whether oneness is selfish or altruistic. I believe there's a middle ground here, and it's one that Darren Beale discovered early on. When he started FreeCycle, he wanted to keep used goods out of landfills by giving them away to people who wanted them. But he also had some personal interests at stake. In his recycling program, he had a warehouse full of stuff he couldn't use or recycle, and his boss wanted the warehouse emptied. In addition, Beale was hoping to get rid of an old mattress that he owned. None of his friends needed it, and it was too big to throw away. To dump it, he would need to borrow a truck and drive the mattress to a landfill, where he would be charged for disposal. Beale realized it would be easier and cheaper if he could just give it away to someone on FreeCycle. This is why many takers and matchers started giving on FreeCycle. It's an efficient way to get rid of things they don't want, and probably can't sell on Craigslist. But soon, Beale knows from personal experience, people who initially give things away for selfish reasons begin to care about the people they're helping. When the recipient arranged to pick up his mattress, Beale was thrilled. "I thought I was getting away with giving a mattress away, that I was the one benefiting," he says. "But when the person showed up at my door and thanked me, I felt good. It was only partially a selfish act. I was helping someone else in a way that made me happy. I felt so darn good about it that I started giving away other items." After a decade of research, I've come to the conclusion that Beale's experience is the norm rather than the exception. Oneness is otherish. Most of the time that we give, it's based on a cocktail of mixed motives to benefit others and ourselves. Takers and matchers may be most likely to give when they feel they can advance others' interests and their own at the same time. As the primatologist Franz Duval writes in The Age of Empathy, the selfish-unselfish divide may be a red herring. Why try to extract the self from the other, or the other from the self, if the merging of the two is the secret behind our cooperative nature? Consider Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia written for free by upwards of 3 million volunteers, with more than 100,000 of them contributing regularly. When asked why they write for Wikipedia, hardly any volunteers reported being involved for self-serving reasons, such as to make new contacts, build their reputations, reduce loneliness, or feel valued and needed. But the relatively altruistic value of helping others wasn't the sole factor they emphasized either. Wikipedia contributors aren't necessarily givers across the different domains of their lives, but they're volunteering their time to exhaustively summarize and cross-reference Wikipedia entries. Why? In a survey, two reasons dominated all others. They thought it was fun, and they believed information should be free. For many volunteers, writing Wikipedia entries is otherish. It provides personal enjoyment and benefits others. Beale believes the otherish structure of FreeCycle is one of the major reasons that it grew so fast. Giving away items that we don't need and benefiting others in the process is the gift economy equivalent of Adam Rifkin's 5-minute favors. Low cost to oneself, coupled with potentially high benefit to others. It's noteworthy that FreeCycle's formal mission statement highlights two sets of benefits. Members can contribute to others and gain for themselves. The mission is to build a worldwide gifting movement that reduces waste, saves precious resources, and eases the burden on our landfills while enabling our members to benefit from the strength of a larger community. Beyond this otherish structure, there's a central feature of a FreeCycle community that motivates people to start giving. A clue to the mechanism lies in the story of a French consultant who struggled for years to earn the trust of a potential client until he recognized the power of a sense of community. From enemies to allies. During the 2008 global financial crisis, one of the many companies to suffer was a French firm that I'll call Nouveau. Nouveau was headquartered in a small city in the middle of France that boasted a beloved soccer team. The founders had chosen the city as their headquarters in an effort to restore the city's glory, but the population was shrinking and profits were falling, and there was pressure to relocate to a larger city. Nouveau's executives decided to save headquarters with a dramatic reorganization. Seeking outside assistance, the CFO issued a request for proposals to consulting firms. Nouveau was open to working with whichever firm presented the best proposal, with one exception. One particular consulting firm could not be trusted. This firm had been working with Nouveau's chief competitor for years. Nouveau's top brass worried that inside information could be leaked accidentally or even stolen by a taker. The lead partner, hoping to win the business for the suspect consulting firm, whom I'll call Philippe, was aware of the distrust from the Nouveau executives. Philippe's firm had submitted proposals to Nouveau in the past, and they were always rejected. The consultants had repeatedly explained the firm's strict confidentiality policies, but the Nouveau executives didn't buy it. Eventually, the consultants concluded that it was a waste of time to continue making proposals. But Philippe was genuinely interested in contributing to Nouveau's success, so he led his team in preparing and submitting a proposal for the reorganization. Then they sat down to brainstorm. How can we prove to Nouveau that we're trustworthy? Philippe's firm was the last to pitch to Nouveau. At the pitch meeting, Philippe arrived at Nouveau's headquarters with five consultants in tow. They were escorted into a large room where 10 Nouveau executives sat across from them. Philippe's team presented the proposal, and the Nouveau executives were unmoved. "We like your proposal," one executive said. "But we can't trust you. Why should we enter into a relationship with you? How can we be sure that you will put our interests first?" Philippe reminded them of his firm's confidentiality policies and code of honor, reinforcing that its reputation hinged on upholding the highest standards for clients. But his promise fell on deaf ears. Philippe had run out of logical arguments, so he resorted to the only other ammunition that he had. He reached into his briefcase and pulled out the blue scarf of the city's famed soccer club. Donning the scarf as a symbol of hometown pride, he made a plea. "We've been trying to convince you for many years that our confidentiality policies can be trusted. Since we're not managing to say that with words, we'd like to show our commitment in a different way." The five members of Philippe's team followed suit, putting the soccer scarves around their necks. The Nouveau executives were surprised. They asked which partner would take the lead on the project. Philippe stepped up. "I am going to take the lead, and we will begin our work over the August break. I can commit to this because your headquarters is next to my home." A few hours later, Philippe's firm landed the project. The Nouveau executives had not known that Philippe was from their city. "This was a reorganization task," Philippe explains, "and having someone care about this city and the people living in it was a plus for the employees and the company. It was a bit of common ground." Common ground is a major influence on giving behaviors. In one experiment, psychologists in the United Kingdom recruited fans of the Manchester United soccer team for a study. When walking from one building to another, the soccer fan saw a runner slip on a grass bank, where he fell, holding his ankle and screaming in pain. Would they help him? It depended on the t-shirt that he was wearing. When he wore a plain t-shirt, only 33% helped. When he wore a Manchester United t-shirt, 92% helped. Yale psychologist Jack DeVideo calls this activating a common identity. When people share an identity with another person, giving to that person takes on an otherish quality. If we help people who belong to our group, we're also helping ourselves, as we're making the